and I'll be your host. Moth storytellers are regular people from all walks of life. No notes are allowed at the Moth. It's just the storyteller, the audience, and a microphone. We've got four stories for you this hour, three from our Moth main stage series and one from our Teen Moth Shop community program. Up first is Joan Juliet Buck. It's a story she told at a recent Moth night called Dial M for Moth Thriller Stories. Joan is one of the best-dressed storytellers to ever take the Moth stage. And to give you an idea, she wore a mauve to her wedding, and the dress is now in the collection at the Metropolitan Museum. Here's Joan live at the Moth.
So, they say that ghosts are people caught between two worlds. I'm caught between two worlds. I'm an American who passes for a French person. This makes me really rare. It also means, I don't know if I'm American or French, it also means that 15 years ago, I was asked to go to Paris as editor-in-chief of Paris Vogue. The first time an American has ever been asked to edit a French publication, and the last. I wasn't used to working in offices. I hadn't had a desk job at that point for years. And so I had to go to Paris and act like a grown-up. And I also needed to work very hard. But worse than that, I had to find an apartment that would be fitting for my station. So I looked at a lot of apartments, and they were too big or too small or too dingy or too dark, or all of them too ordinary. Until one day, I was in the Rue Jacob, every American's favorite Paris street. The Rue Jacob is picturesque, it's on the left bank, and it's easy to pronounce, Jacob. And it's full of antique shops that have very beautiful objects in them, objects that you would want to put in your very beautiful apartment on the Rue Jacob, if you could find such a thing, which I did. Up a stone staircase from the 17th century, the color of honey or freshly baked bread, two gigantic lacquered doors opened into a foyer, and there was a dining room on the right, and then there was a living room 18 feet wide, 18 feet long, and 18 feet high. A perfect cube. And next to it was an American kitchen, the realtor said. I was reassured. And there was a study. There was a long corridor, and at the end of that was a bedroom that was another perfect cube. All of this perfection covered in moldings from the late 18th century, 5 minutes before the revolution. The place was perfect. Also, 15 years ago, this perfection, this palace, cost only $200 more than my rather dingy, boring apartment on the Upper East Side. So I found myself in the office of a pair of rather peculiar lawyers near the Place Saint-Sulpice, and they put this piece of paper on the desk, and they read. They said, "Madame, you must hereby attest that we have informed you on this day that the apartment situated at 11 Rue Jacob moves at night. Please sign here and initial on top." So I sign, I initial. They also warned me that given who I was and what I was doing in Paris, I would certainly be giving parties in this magnificent apartment. If I could possibly keep the more corpulent guests around the perimeter, because they couldn't really vouch for the safety of the middle of the floor. So the possessor of this very beautiful rental, I move in. I figure out that I'm going to put the bed on the wall that's between, there's this wall between the study and the bedroom. I put the bed there. What am I going to do about the very high windows? Oh, beige felt curtains, felt cheap, practical. And all the French people say, "Oh, that is so intelligent, felt." And I give a party, and I keep the more corpulent people around the perimeter, and there's an exceptionally fat Italian designer who I keep by the window. I ask him to, "Please, will you make sure, tell me who's coming?" And these parties are not really parties, they're work. Everything is work. I'm working 20 hours a day. So that when I come home to bed, I crash. I sleep like a dead person. After 4 months, I realize I don't have to work 20 hours a day. I can work 19 hours a day. So I'm beginning to get a bit more normal. And that's when, in the middle of the night, one night, I awaken because there is a pull on the bedclothes on my left, as if somebody's lying on the covers next to me. And there's a soft little hand touching my forehead. And I lie there wondering if somebody's actually in the room. And with a great act of courage, I put out my arm and I turn on the light, and there's no one there. Now, I'm the editor-in-chief of Paris Vogue. I absolutely refuse to believe that any of this nonsense is happening. It's ridiculous. However, the next day, I do go around the corner to the church of Saint-Germain-des-Prés. And I'm not quite sure how you do these things, but I go into the office, and there's a woman there making notes in a little notebook, and I wait. And she looks up, she asks me for my name. I give a fake name because, you know, I don't want people to know that I think what I'm about to tell her. And it's not the right kind of name. She looks at me skeptically. And I say, I live around the corner, and I think my apartment is maybe haunted. Is there a priest who could come and... And the woman who's got a greasy bun and greasy glasses looks at me through the greasy glasses with total contempt. And she says, Madame, that is superstition. So I leave the Church of Saint-Germain-des-Prés, and I know one thing. I'm not going to let a single person in Paris know that I'm crazy enough to think that there's something in my bedroom at night. So I go back. I give another party. Everybody says it's so wonderful. And I don't tell anyone what happens at night in my room. And in fact, I'm really lonely, so, you know, it's not bad. So, one June morning, a cold, freezing June morning, I wake up, one of those horrible, gray French June mornings, and I turn on my light, and there's no electricity. And I think, oh my God, I forgot to pay the bill, and they've cut me off. The French, they're always punishing you. So I go to the office, I get the bill paid. That evening, I have dinner with friends who are Italian. They're really nice. I've known them a long time. Maybe I can confide in them. And I do. And the wife says, wait a second. You have no electricity. You have something in your bedroom. And you're going home tonight and you're going to, like, go to your bedroom with a candle? No, no. Come stay with us tonight. I say, great, great, great. Thank you very much. Can I please just pack a little bag? So we go back to my apartment. We put the husband in the living room with some tequila. And the wife says, let's take a look at this ghost of yours. So I walk down the long corridor with two votive candles. And I know there's nothing to see because I've never seen anything. And we go into the bedroom. And I turn to face the bed. And there on the bed, I see the indentation of a body lying there. At that very moment, the wife says, you know what? I think I'll wait for you in the living room. So now I really don't know what to do, because if I ask her if she's seen it and she hasn't seen it, I'm nuts. So I just let her go, and I put my candles down and I pack my little bag. And the next morning, the bill is paid, the electricity is put on again, and that evening when I come home, the first thing I do, I move that bed from that weird wall over to the other side of the room, in front of the bricked-up fireplace, underneath the mantelpiece that's made of marble that looks a little bit like a tombstone. But it's kind of a good place for the bed. And all the French people come and look at the bedroom, and they say, you know, you really want to sleep there because it looks like a grave. And so I lie. I say, oh, I really like it. And they say, it's very punk. Yes. So when I'm sleeping over there, nothing happens. I'm okay. And I think about the building, and the people who own the building have exactly the same apartment above me. Foyer, dining room, the cube, living room, the study, the bedroom. And one October night, I'm awoken in the middle of the night by the sound of somebody in the room above me, being thrown from one end of a wooden floor to the other and hitting the far wall with a thud, and then there's a scream, and then there are blows and more screams and wails and cries and some kind of snorting sound, and the sound of the violence is so loud that my room is moving. So I put on some shoes, I put on a coat, I run downstairs to the courtyard because I want to see what's happening in that room above my room. And I see my pale beige felt curtains in my window, and above, I don't see anything. There's no noise, there's nothing moving, there's no light, there's no shadows. There's just the October full moon reflected in the closed windows. So I go back up to my room, and I do what any American would do. I get out a sage stick from New Mexico, and I light it, and I get a shell, and I put it on the table next to my bed, and I put the sage stick in the shell, because this is going to get rid of whatever's going on. But the flames jump up. The flames multiply. Something in my bedroom is feeding the sage stick. And it burns so bright and so hard that it scorches the table. The next day, I call my neighbors, my owners, and I insist on going upstairs for a drink. I'm going to be really brave. And I go up the stairs, and they offer me a really teeny glass of wine, and they show me their apartment, and it's terribly neat and rather austere, just like them. And I say, so your apartment is exactly like mine? They say, yes, yes. But, of course, we sleep in the dining room. I say, oh, really? Why don't... Oh, no, no, no. We never go into the back room. No, no, no. We're much happier in the dining room. Okay, so now I really don't know what to do, because I'm not going back to the Catholic Church after they've humiliated me like that. But I have a tame Tibetan acupuncturist. I go to Dr. Tong Lang, and I say... Do you ever do any exorcism? He says, well, not personally, but I work with lamas who can clean various auras and various places just by looking at photographs. So I go back to my place. I photograph the bedroom. This was 1997. I take the photos to be developed. You know, I don't want anybody at the magazine to know about this. After the fashion shows, the photos are developed. I take them in to the Tibetan Lama acupuncturist, and he promises that he will get it to the other lamas. And I think, you know, I'm out of my mind, right? Then my father comes to stay, and he thinks the apartment's very beautiful. I don't discuss anything about what I might suspect. We're standing outside the apartment, outside the glorious lacquered doors one day, and he's just standing there, stock still, and suddenly he's thrown down the stairs. And I run down, I pick him up, he's actually okay, but I know that something from the apartment threw him down the stairs, and that's it. I go to the right bank, I find an apartment, an ordinary 19th century apartment with no drama about it. And everybody in Paris says, you're moving to the right bank when you have this palace on the Rue Jacob? And I say, you know what? I really think the left bank is just so over. And they say, you're right. So one day I'm in the cafe floor. I haven't quite moved yet. And there's a young designer who I know vaguely, who's been to the parties, who comes running up to me, who says, Cherie, you're leaving that apartment. And I say, yes. And he says, how can you do that? I say, well, you know. And he says, tell me something. I would do anything to live in that apartment. Have you given the lease to someone else? I say, no. He says, is there someone else living there? And I have a moment where I think, And then I think he'd tell everybody. And I know he'd tell everybody. And he says, please, 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 I want to live in that apartment. Can I have the lease? And I say, yes. So I give him the lease. I move to the right bank. I get a boyfriend. I'm no longer lonely. The magazine begins to sell incredibly well. I become friends with Malcolm McLaren. Everything goes absolutely fabulously. And Once in a while, I go to the Rue Jacob because I would like some antiques to put in my 19th century apartment. And sometimes I pass in front of my old place and I see that there's a scaffolding. I see there are painters doing extraordinary things to it. Karl Lagerfeld is apparently paying for all the work. And I never go up there. I never run into the young designer anymore. He's nowhere to be seen. 2-3 years later, I see him in Milan. And I say, hey, you're not in Paris anymore. He says, well, you know, I never sleep in Paris. I sleep in Rome, I sleep in Milan, I sleep in Brussels, I sleep in London, and I'll sleep at the airport. And I say, really, how's our apartment? He says, oh, honey, it's so haunted.
That was Joan Juliet Buck. Joan was the editor-in-chief of French Vogue for 7 years, and to this day, she's the only American to have edited any French magazine. Do you have a moth story? We want to hear it. Don't be shy. Call our pitch hotline at 877-799-MOTH. That's 877-799-6684. You'll have only a 1 minute window to hook us, or log on to themoth.org to record your pitch right on the web. The Moth Radio Hour will continue in a moment. When we come back, we'll hear a story about a hospital break on motorcycle.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
WILL programming is made possible by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting the opening night party, featuring Mariachi Sol de Mexico de Jose Hernandez, Tiempo Libre, Samba Soul, and others on Friday, September 12th at 6 p.m. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com.
From PRX, this is the Moth Radio Hour. I'm Sarah Austin-Jeness. Our next story is from Mike DiStefano. We met Mike when we directed a show at a comedy festival, but at the Moth, comedians can't rely on shtick. They have to leave their comfort zone and tell a true story about their lives. Mike told us about his wife, Franny.
When I was a kid, I wanted to get a Harley really bad. I was about 7. And I saw these guys riding. I was in my dad's car in the back, and these dudes were driving by on this Harleys. And I remember looking at them and saying, I want to do that, man, you know? I want to be free like those guys. And, you know, I started doing heroin a few years later, so I couldn't really get a bike. I couldn't get toothpaste, you know, let alone a $15,000 motorcycle. When I was 18, my parents found me in the house, overdosed, almost dead. And they took me to a hospital, and then they took me to a detox, and then to a rehab. When I was in the rehab, I met Fran. She was a beautiful, beautiful girl. The first time I saw her, I was just like, wow, amazed. And we started becoming really close, and we went through the rehab. She had been there a long time before me, and she was finishing up, and I was just starting out. And she finished the rehab, and I was still in there. And then I finished, and we started dating. And life was pretty good, you know. It was hard to get off of heroin, but I was able to do it. And I went to college. I started in college, and Franny and I were together and dating and just having a good time. And one day, she had a really bad fever. I took her to the hospital, and 12 hours later, they said that she had this pneumocystic pneumonia. I don't know what it was, and they said it was from AIDS. And I don't know what to do. I loved her, and I wanted to be with her. New York got her sick a lot. She'd cough a lot and had bronchitis all the time, so we moved to Florida, like when old people moved down there. We went down to retire. I figured that we would live as much as we could and do everything we could, and for some reason I just wanted to make her life the greatest life. And we got married, and we were living in Florida, and I thought the warm air down there would help her heal and feel better, but it didn't. She went into the hospital one night, and the next morning the doctor told me that she had pneumonia again, and that they couldn't really cure it, and that she might have a few weeks to live. And that was the first time I was told that, and I was devastated, and she was devastated. And they put her in a hospice. And 2 weeks later, they sent her out of the hospice because she started to get better. She was like thrown out of hospice for not dying. And only she could pull that off. She was a young Italian girl, and she was not interested in suffering and dying. Like, who is? But she was extra not into it. A few weeks later, she got sick again. I took her back to the hospital. They put her in. Doctor told me the same thing. She's going to, a few weeks, and she's going to be gone. So they put her back in hospice. A month and a half later, they sent her home again. And you know, our families, my parents, her parents were happy about it. Oh, she's going to be better. But I knew how the story, you know, I know how the story's going to end. And a few weeks later, she ends up back in the hospital. And on a Thursday of that week, my motorcycle, my Harley Davidson, was ready to be picked up, you know. So I went that Thursday to get the bike, and it was beautiful. She was in the hospital, and I got a call that she went back to hospice. So the day I got the bike, she was back in hospice. So I drove the bike over to the hospice, and I didn't know what to do. You know, should I show her the bike? What do you do? So I went in, I brought the bike out front, and I went into the room, and I said, "Franny, I want to show you something." And I brought her outside and showed her the bike, and she was mad, you know. She's like, "What the f*** is that?" I thought, I brought it to her because it was our dream together, and she was still very important to me, and I just thought that would make her happy, but it didn't. So the social worker came over to me and said, "Mike, you know, people are never dying. They live, and then they die. And dying is in a moment. And she feels that you're treating her as if she's dying, and you don't need her anymore. And you don't love her anymore." And, you know, that wasn't the truth, you know. And I didn't know how to tell her it. And I told her every day. We used to go out for dinners and stuff. She wanted to go out. I would take her out. She'd have her oxygen tank with her, and I'd take her to a restaurant, and I'd look around, and I'd see another couple with the husband and taking care of the wife, but they were 80. You know, we were 20. And so I went home, and I didn't know what to do, and I came back to the hospice, and I brought a few of my work shirts with me because, like, she loved ironing for me. She was here now, she'd yell. So I came back a couple hours later, and my shirts were all ironed, and she was walking around the hospice dusting like she would clean the place up. She was on a lot of morphine, and that some of you that never did it, it's wonderful, and it makes you feel excited about things. So, and then she saw me, and she's like, "Where's the bike?" You know, like everything I wanted her to feel in the beginning, she felt. Because I asked her to iron my clothes. And I said, it's outside. Let's go see, you know. And I took her out, and she said, let me sit on it. So I put her on it. And then she said, can you start it up? And she's still alive, so she's still a woman, and this is not enough. I want that. I start the bike up, and it's rumbling, you know. It was a loud bike. It was gorgeous. And then she's, can you just take me for a little ride, like just around the parking lot here? And I'm like, I'm thinking she's going to fall off the bat, you know. And I have to tell her family, you know, yeah, she almost died of AIDS. But then I killed her on my bike. I promised her that, like, that the rest of my life would be, first of all, I was going to live for her. Like, I mean, really live. And I would always talk about her. I don't want to be here telling this story. I promised her I would. So now we're riding around the hospice, you know, and she got the morphine pole next to her. You know, and we're junkies, you know. We were junkies. We were different. We were freaks. We were people. People crossed the street when they saw me, you know. And her, she was a prostitute. She was a drug addict. I mean, all the shit that, you know what I'm talking about, some of you. I can tell. So this was amazing, you know. So we're riding around this hospice with this morphine pole jangling. And all the staff come out, and they're watching us, like, you know, and they're cheering us on. It's all these gay dudes and people that cared about people dying, you know. Yeah, none of my friends were there, you know, Frankie and Vinny. They didn't show up. So they're all, watching us. And then I hear the pole fall, and I literally think she fell off the back. You know, she unhooked the morphine bag, which means I want to go out on the street a little bit. So I take her out on the street a little bit, and then she just put her arm around my belly and started rubbing, and she said, can we go on the highway? And I thought of all that we've been through and all the suffering, and I said, yeah, we could do that. So I was on, we got on I-95 and added up to 80. And she was just screaming happiness. Morphine bag was... And for 10 minutes, you know, that wind, like I always imagined the wind on a bike making you feel free, you know? It's so powerful. For 10 minutes we were normal, and that wind just blew all the death off of us. And here I am in Aspen, and I want to be, you know, I want a special and HBOs and money, but nothing I'll ever do will be that grand. Thank you.
That story was from Mike DiStefano. Stay tuned for more stories from The Moth. When we come back, Daryl DMC McDaniels tells us a story about the angel who brought him back from the brink.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Bob Gaudio, who played with the Four Seasons and wrote or co-wrote their hits. He's one of the people behind the Broadway musical Jersey Boys. A new anthology collects his songs as performed by the Four Seasons, Frankie Valli, and others. Join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 and again at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and with support from Lincoln Square in Urbana, a lifestyle center with unique and independently owned food stores and entertainment facilities like Common Ground Food Co-op and Black Rock Pizza Company at 88 Broadway.
I'm Sarah Austin Jeunesse, your host this time for the Moth Radio Hour. Our next story is from Daryl DMC McDaniels, part of the legendary rap group Run DMC. Here's DMC live on the Moth National Story Tour at Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland.
Hi. Everything happens for a reason. Everything happens for a reason. I'm going to tell you all about what happened to me when I asked myself, why am I here? I do that every day now. I ask myself, why am I here today in front of y'all? But I'm here today in front of y'all to tell you what happened when I asked myself, why am I here several years ago? Several years ago, I was on tour with my band Run DMC. We was over in Europe. Now, we was in Europe. We was out there doing shows. We was getting $40,000, $50,000 a night. But for some reason, something in me wasn't right. Had no idea what it was. So on this particular evening after the show, I got back to my room and I asked myself, am I here just to be DMC? And I laid there that night and I thought about everything that happened to me. Okay, I'm Daryl McDaniels. I grew up in Hollis, Queens, New York. Piping and Banner is my mother and father. My brother is Alfred. My mother and father worked every day to send me to every school that I went to. And every school that I went to was a Catholic school that they worked every day to pay for me to go to. And I treated them right by coming home with straight A's every day. I was an athletic kid for me as a kid. Every day, not materially, but every day as a kid, it was Christmas for me. Life couldn't be no better. And then growing up in Hollis, Queens, I met Joe and Jay, and we did the things that young guys do, and then we call ourselves starting a rap group, and we put a record out, and then the record goes number one, and then we, you know, damn near created hip-hop, and we was the first to go gold, first to go platinum, all this good stuff, Rolling Stone, MTV, and now here I am, laying in Europe, getting $40,000, $50,000 tonight. But why am I so unhappy? I was laying there, and I summed up everything that was mean. I was unhappy to the point where I was so depressed. And out of that, I became very suicidal. Now, I had suicidal thoughts, so I don't think I really killed myself, because I did go to the ledge and look, and I looked and said, I ain't jumping. It's going to hurt. Put the poison in the glass, and I thought about drinking the poison, and I looked at it and I said, I ain't drinking that. Thought about the gun the whole nine. But I knew something was wrong with me, even though life was good, because I had suicidal thoughts. So I was saying, okay, I got to figure out how to kill myself. No, I'm not. Whatever. But then I came to the conclusion, I can't kill myself on the road while we're touring, because Run and Jay is going to be mad at me. So I'm going to just wait till I get home. So we finished. We did what we had to do on a tour in Europe. And I came home very depressed, didn't know what this void was in me, because I summed up everything about me. I'm supposed to be happy. I get in the car, and the limo driver goes, you want to turn to hear some music? And I'm like, yeah, just turn the radio on. You have a preference? No, just turn it on. So he turns the radio on. And this was in 1997. And on the radio was a record called Angel by Sarah McLachlan. Now look, fame, friends, fortune, and even my family, my wife and kids, didn't mean nothing to me, because I was suicidal, I was depressed, I was an emotional wreck. But for some reason, when I heard that record, Angel, by Sarah McLachlan, something in me said, life is beautiful, it's good to be alive. So, for one whole year, All I did was listen to Sarah McLachlan's record, Angel, for one whole year. Not only that, I went out and brought every record she ever made, and the only thing that I was living for was Sarah McLachlan. Over and over and over, everywhere I went, I was driving my management crazy because I would be like, come on, D, we got to go on the road, or you got to put this in. They would go, no. I said, then I ain't going. And they would be like, okay, we'll put it in for you. And they're like, there's something matter, Ricky. What's up with this? You listen to Sarah McLachlan, whatever, whatever. So for 1 year, I'm listening to Sarah McLachlan. At the end of the year, my manager goes, yo, D, I got tickets to Clive Davis' Grammy party. You know who Clive Davis is, right? If you win American Idol, you get a deal with Clive Davis. He discovered Janis Joplin and all these people. But I'm like, I have no time for Clive Davis in Hollywood because I have my Sarah McLachlan. That's all I care about. So he's like, yo, D, man, I went through a hard time to get these tickets to blah, blah, blah. I'm looking at it. Okay, I say, okay, I'll go to the party, but I'm only staying 1 hour. So I go to the party, Clive Davis Grammy party in L.A. I'm counting the seconds, 59, 58. I'm looking around, and there's Stevie Wonder, so the why? Alicia Keys, who cares about Alicia Keys? Paparazzi and Pam Anderson and all this stuff, right? I'm in there hating on everything. So I'm sitting there at a party that I did not want to go to because all I want to do is listen to my Sarah McLachlan music. But guess who walks in? That lady. She was that lady to me. She was that lady to me then. That lady that made that record that changed my life. I'm losing it because nobody in the whole facility knows I'm an in-the-closet Sarah McLachlan fan. But I'm losing it. I'm like, oh my, that's that lady. So I get myself together. I say, okay, I got to go over there. If I do die, kill myself, whatever, I got to go over there and let her know what her record did for me. So I walk over to Sarah McLachlan. I'm in the whole Run DMC garb, the hat, the black, all the way down. She sees me coming. She goes, DMC? It's tricky to rock a rhyme, rock a rhyme. My Adidas, they walk this way. I'm like, wow. But in my head, this is where I was at. In my head, I'm like, that's a good reason to stay alive because Sarah McLachlan likes my music. That's where I was at, y'all. I go over to her and I say, hey, Miss McLachlan, I just want to tell you, your record angel saved my life. I was depressed. I was suicidal. But every day I listen to that record. I don't leave the house without listening to that record. It's the crutch I stand on. It's like everything I do revolves around that record. And listen, the record is called Angel. You sing like an angel. People say you are an angel, but you're not an angel to me. You're God. And I go on and on and on and on. But she's looking at me like, okay, where is this coming from? I just wanted to say hi to his ass. So I finish my little rant. She looks at me and she goes, she ain't know what to say. Thank you for telling me that, Daryl, because that's what music is supposed to do. 3 whole years go by. She takes my hand, walks away. 3 whole years go by. I'm trying to figure out what this void in me, this and that, why I don't want to kill myself. But I ain't going to kill myself because I got my Sarah McLachlan music. I'm listening to Sarah McLachlan, figuring out why am I crazy. I'm going through a lot of emotions. Then I realize something. People know my musical legacy. What Run DMC did, first to go gold, first to go platinum, first on MTV, first with a record deal, first on all the first. But nobody knows the legacy. Nobody knows about the little boy Daryl who became DMC. So I said, if I die, my friends and my fans and people that I grew up with, my generation, they just know DMC, what DMC did. They don't know about Daryl, and especially the younger generation. So I said, I got to write a book. So I'm going to write a book, and it's going to be, yo, what's up? My name is DMC. You know me. Daryl McTannis, Run DMC. First to go gold, first to go platinum, first on MTV, first on Rolling Stone. All the first. I got to the point where I wanted to write, yeah, I was born May 31st, 1964. When I got to that point, I realized that's all I know about the day I was born. So I said, I got to figure out, you know, the details of my birth. So I called my mother up. Hey, Mom. Hey, Daryl. How you doing? Love you, too. Did you eat? Yeah, Mom. I mean, you're losing too much weight. No, Mom, I'm working out. It's a difference. But whatever, whatever. I just need to know 3 things because I'm writing this book. How much did I weigh? What time was I born? And what hospital? She told me those 3 things. Love you, too. Hung up the phone. Boom. About an hour later, the phone rings. It's my mother and my father. Hey, son, how you doing? What's up, Dad? Yo, what's up? We have something else to tell you. Blah, blah, this, blah, blah, that, blah, blah, blah. You was a month old. We think you're Dominican, and you're adopted. You're adopted. You're adopted. You're adopted. You're adopted. You're adopted. Right then and there, whole world stopped. Thought about all of Run DMC stuff, St. John's University High School when I was a little kid, and I thought about all the stuff that I was laying in a bed 3 years, a couple of years earlier, saying, am I here just to be DMC? Summed up everything about me That was the one void, the piece of the missing link that had me going out of my mind, suicidal, because that was the one thing I didn't know about myself. Now, if you think there's really a time to commit suicide, finding out you're adopted at age 35, and people say, D, they told you over the phone. But right then and there, something happened. I remembered, when I asked myself in my head, the DMC and summed it up, that was the missing void. So the void was filled. I really wanted to kill myself, but then I remembered something. Sarah McLachlan said, that's what music is supposed to do. So I said, okay, before I get suicidal, depressed, and do something real crazy, she said, that's what music is supposed to do. I said, I need to write a record that's going to help that little orphan or that little kid in foster care who thinks they threw me away, I'm worthless, I mean nothing, my mother and father love you, because I may be DMC, but what I really represent is purpose and destiny. So I need to make a record that's going to inspire somebody the way Sarah McLachlan inspired me. Then I got a bigger idea. I'm going to call that lady back up, have that lady make the record with me. So get Sarah McLachlan on the phone, and I'm thinking, if she thought I was crazy 3 years ago, she's going to really think I'm crazy now. Hey, Miss McLachlan, it's Darryl. Remember me? How could I forget you, Darryl? You called me God. What do you want? Okay, here we go. Remember when I met you 3 years ago and I told you what your record did for me? Yeah. And then you looked at me and you told me that's what music is supposed to do. Yeah, well, I found out why I was going depressed and suicidal. Blasey by this, but my mother and father told me I'm adopted. I need to make a record that's going to inspire me the way, inspire people the way your record is inspiring me. Blasey, blah, blah, blah. Will you help me do this record? She goes, yes, real quick. I was like, wow, that was easy. I'm losing it now. I'm like, she said, yes, this and that. I'll fly you to New York, put you in the Four Seasons studio. She says, no, Darryl, you could come to my house and make the record. Now, I'm a fan now after 4 years of listening to this lady. I'm a fan now, right? To make a long story short, when she said, come to my house, I fainted. I woke up. I was in Vancouver, Canada. It's beautiful there. At Sarah McLachlan's house, the lady whose record saved my life, right? Now, listen, we went there. I said, Miss McLachlan, I want to make a remake of Harry Chapin's Cats in the Cradle. And I'm going to put my adoption story there, and I'm going to give it a happy ending. Okay, cool. Took us 2 days to make the record. Now, listen, it all started in the car with her record coming on the radio, right? A year goes by. I go to a party that I did not want to go to. Who walks in? Then I find out that I was adopted. I call her up to do the record with me. So we did the record, right? All happy. I was on my way out the door, and she says, Darryl, before you go, I got to tell you something. Now, I love her to death, her music, everything what she did for me. I'm in heaven. I'm on cloud nine. Whatever it is you want, Miss McLachlan. She says, before you go, I need to tell you something, Darryl. And I said, what? She says, I was adopted too, and I did not know that. Everything happens for a reason.
That was Darryl DMC McDaniels. Darryl was recently inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
In the arms of the angel, fly away from here, from this dark, cold hotel room, and the endlessness that you fear. Your silent reverie. You're in the arms of the angel. May you find some comfort here.
This is the Moth Radio Hour. Our final story is from Terrence Buckner. Terrence lives in Brownsville, Brooklyn, but he takes the subway an hour every day to Wadley High School in Harlem. Terrence was part of our Moth Shop program, where we teach storytelling workshops free of charge to teens and adults. Here's Terrence.
The thing about where I'm from, which is Brooklyn, Brownsville and Brooklyn, it's really not good to be a guy and be gay at the same time, because you would get harassed, you would get picked on, you get beat up, you would get like the worst thing, the worst looks from people, and nobody would really want that. because I was 13, so I really didn't want any more peer pressure than I already had on me already. So I wanted to tell my mom, and when I thought about it, I always thought about what happens if I told my mom, like, all the other parents, they would disown their children, they would kick them out, and I never wanted that for me. So, but then one day I just thought in my head, you know what, this is one thing my mom has to know. And I said, Mom, if I was gay, what would you love me more or love me less? And she said, TK, I'll love you no matter what happens in this world, you'll always be my son. And then when she said that, I was like, oh, well, I'm gay. And she was like, and she said, oh, okay, see, I still love you. You're not going to just go, I'm not going to kick you out or anything, or what was you thinking? And I was like, no, Mom, I would never think that. And so when I woke up in the morning, I wanted to wear something different from the usual Terrence that everyone knows. So I put on black skinny jeans, black and white Converses, and red and white checkerboard shirt. I was walking home, and it was around like 4:35 o'clock. It was during the wintertime, so it got really dark really soon outside, and I was walking through the projects. So I was just walking, and a group of kids, like 7 kids, just walked up to me and said, yo, you got a problem? And I said, what are you talking about? And right when I said that, right when I said, what are you talking about, I just felt I saw a big flash of light, of white light, and like a big bash to my head. Like I was like, and then I just saw myself falling. And in my head, I was like, God, please let me get out of this safe. Please let me get out of here. Please let me get away from these kids. Please let me fight back. I was just praying to God to, like, let me get out the situation. And then all I feel is me just get up, and, like, I see all these kids in front of me. I just close my eyes and just start swinging at everybody. I did not know who I hit. I just know I hit a lot of people. And then, like, after I opened my eyes, I saw this one opening to the right of me where I was walking before. And even though I was really tired, I was really hurt, I was really messed up, I still ran for my life. I was running like there was no tomorrow. I was running till I got to my house where I knew I was safe. And then she opened the door and she said, TK, what's wrong? What happened? Who did this? What's wrong? And I was like, Mom, these kids beat me up. She said, who? I said, I don't know. It's just, and then she called the police. And when I woke up in the next morning, even though I was really busted up, I had a big bump on my head, my lip was busted, my nose was messed up and everything, my mom said I still had to go to school. Usually it would take me like 10 minutes to get dressed, but that day it took me like a good 45 minutes to get dressed because I did not know what to wear, because I had my baggy jeans, the regular jeans I wore, and then I had more skinny jeans. So I was thinking to myself, if I'll go back to the baggy jeans, that means that I let them win. That means that I'm weaker. I gave them last laugh. They won the battle and the war. But then I looked at the skinny jeans, and I just thought about me being powerful, me winning the war. And I said, you know what, forget them. And I put on my skinny jeans. And after that day, I really didn't care what anybody said about me. I was always going to be the crazy, insane, like, psychotic person you'll ever meet. I'm always going to be outgoing, wear crazy stuff, wear retro stuff, nerdy, anything I could find that goes together, I would wear it, and I wouldn't worry about anybody else. And that's my story.
That was Terrence Buckner. Terrence received the Moth Shop Scholarship, which he'll use to help him go to college in California to study theater and psychology. He's now also a teen story coach with The Moth. Here's some of what Terrence had to say when he received his award at the annual Moth Ball.
I grew up in a ghetto, so like I'm like where the what gangster stuff is. And actually, I just recently saw the people that beat me up that day, and they're bench boys. They're just sitting there having nothing to do with their lives. They don't go to school. They don't do anything with themselves. So, like, I won the war. I won everything, okay?
That's all for the Moth Radio Hour this time. Want to hear more stories? Sign up for our free podcast or pitch your own story. Go to themoth.org for more information. That's themoth.org. I hope you'll join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour, and thanks for listening.
Your host this week was Sarah Austin Janess, the Moth's producing director. Sarah also directed the stories in this hour, along with Catherine Burns and Leah Tao.
All right, so what we're going to do is each person's going to say your first line of your story. These are the folks that had their names in the hat and didn't get picked tonight.
The rest of the Moth's directorial staff includes Sarah Haberman, Jennifer Hickson, and Meg Bowles. Production support from Jenna Weiss-Berman and Brandon Ector.
In 10th grade in Cheyenne, Wyoming, I was in the science club. I had never smoked a cigarette, drank a beer, kissed a girl. I weighed under 100 pounds, and I didn't own a car.
Moth stories are true, as remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Moth events are recorded by Argo Studios in New York City, supervised by Paul Ruest.
I grew up in my mother's beauty shop in Texas. This fat little girl sitting on the front porch in a glittered up Burger King crown, dreaming of travel and adventure.
Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour from Stefan Grappelli, Richard Thompson, Run DMC, Sarah McLaughlin, and John Zorn. The Moth is produced for radio by me, Jay Allison, at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, with help